Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to this episode of GoTo Unscripted. I'm Charles Humble. I'm a freelance techie editor, author, and consultant. And this is part of a series of podcasts that I'm doing for GoTo, talking to software engineering leaders. Today, we're joined by Randy Schaup. Randy has spent more than two decades building distributed systems and high-performing teams, and has worked as a senior technology leader at many of the Silicon Valley giants, including eBay, Google, WeWork, and Stitch Fix. He is currently SVP of Engineering at Thrive Market. He also coaches CTOs, advises company, and talks a lot, sometimes at conferences, about software, and he's interested in the nexus of culture, technology, and organization. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Charles. It's great to be with you. Love to chat with you as always.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for doing this. So what attracted you to Thrive Market? It's obviously a smaller company than an eBay or a Google or an Amazon. So what was the sort of attraction there?
Yeah, sure. So Thrive Market, for the very many people that don't know, is an online organic grocery here in the United States. So think Costco meets Whole Foods, but online. And what Costco means is it's a membership model. It's a curated selection, and you get better prices by being a member. Whole Foods angle is it's all organic, sustainable, regenerative. Like, we have 1,000 banned ingredients that we do not have on any of our products. So one of the reasons people love us is because they know we've already done all the looking at the labels. So like, if we say it's allergen safe for you as a gluten-free allergen having person like my son, or various other things, like, we've already done that. So we have 1.6 million members now. I've been around for 10 years, growing more this year than we ever have. And I'm starting to answer your question about why I joined. So I love this phase of company in particular. It is the late stage private, hopefully with fingers crossed, transitioning to public company, you know, sometime over the next while. You know, when the markets, et cetera, permit. And I've done this ride now four times, actually, back in the dot-com boom/bust with a company called Tumbleweed Communications, which did security software. Stitch Fix, I led engineering up to and through their IPO in 2017. WeWork, I led a significant portion of engineering up to and through our not successful IPO in 2019. Happy to tell that story, but that's a whole other podcast. And many series, by the way. If you do a mini, if there's a mini series about a place that you've worked, you probably had a exciting time in the you know, Chinese curse phrase of exciting. And so this will be the fourth for me in this phase, and I love it because the company is large enough so that the eBay, Google et al. Lessons apply. So like, my skills are actually, you know, valuable and useful and can change the trajectory of the company. And it's also small enough so that we can decide together and act on it, like, right now. You know, we can decide, hey, we're going to do feature flags, and boom, tomorrow we're doing feature flags. You know, we can decide to do canary deployments, and boom, tomorrow we're doing canary deployments. So the combination of being able to bring this, the large scale kind of distributed systems and large scale organizational expertise, and have those lessons be relevant, combined with, you know, it's small enough to be able to, like, really change the trajectory of the company, you know, significantly and relatively quickly. I'll highlight the other aspect of it, which I love the mission. So our mission is, again, to bring healthy and sustainable living to everybody. And everybody is a subset of the United States at the moment, but we want it to be a lot of the United States, and maybe then all of the United States, and then expanding out from there. And every time somebody becomes a member, a paid member, we also give a free membership to a first responder, or a teacher, or a veteran, or somebody who's low income. So, you know, it's doing well by doing good, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Can you tell us what the architecture looks like? What are the components you're using? How's it kind of structured?
Yeah, sure. So we're in the monolith transitioning to microservices phase. That's another whole podcast. We might talk about a little bit of that today. But yeah, so, you know, again, we've been around for 10 years and we have 10-year-old software. So we started and are still on Magento, which is a PHP-based open source e-commerce in a box. It was really big 10 years ago. Now you can think Shopify, but there's no company around the open source thing for Magento. So the core of our e-commerce in, out, up, and down is this PHP monolith. We have a constellation of, let's call it 100 services that are around that. And then over time, we find important pieces of the monolith that for reasons need to be extracted, and we extract them into services written typically in Python or in Java. That's the quick overview. We leverage, we're all in on cloud, AWS, all up and down and left and right, no physical infrastructure, except for the Wi-Fi things in the warehouses, because we're a physical business like Stitch Fix was. So we have physical warehouses, and one of my teams builds software and maintains software for that.
Right. Yes. And is that, I presume, because it's not been...
Sorry to interrupt you, Charles. The other thing to complete that thought is, as every small company should, we use a ton of third-party services. So we use a ton of managed services, you know, from AWS, our cloud vendor, but we also use a ton of third-party services for everything that's not our core competency, right? Our core competency is not shipping physical boxes from our warehouses to people. So we leverage a third party called Convey to give us notifications about that. All aspects, you know, internal and external of things that are not core to our mission, we use third parties for that.
Right. Yes. And is that so that you've not been there all that long? So I'm presuming the architecture is largely something you effectively have kind of inherited and are working within. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I started in early March. So that would give me 9.5 months of time here. I mean, the architecture has not, I was going to say not significantly changed. It's probably not changed at all, candidly, since I've been here, where we've built a lot of cool stuff. There's a reason why you use these e-commerce things in a box, because stuff like regional pricing you get for free if you do it right. So, you know, we're doing a lot of work there. We just integrated just now, basically, in the last couple of weeks. We integrated with an Instacart offering around what are called retail ads. So it's ads on our site that are promoted by our vendors for things we already sell. Hope that makes sense. If you're old enough as you and I are to remember like little inserts in the physical newspapers about like, hey, at, you know, your local Aldi or Tesco or Safeway, here are some, you know, it's 5% off this thing or 15% off this other thing. You can think of that. So vendors actually fund, for the most part, those ads. But again, the ads are not for things that are outside of Thrive. They're things for things we already sell.
Right. Yes. Yes. So how naturally does that architecture...
Sorry, Charles. The reason why I mentioned that in the form of architecture is that was an opportunity for us to build a set of services around in Java and use SQS and SNS and the whole deal.
Right. Sorry, yes. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. So how naturally does that architecture fit with the kind of current business domain, where you are as a business, as it were?
Oh, very insightful question. Yeah. So as is absolutely correct for this phase of company, our architecture lags the current state of the business,
right?
Which is correct. Because like if the architecture were ahead of the business, we would have wasted a lot of time building things that we didn't need. And so as we might talk about later, like eBay, Twitter, Amazon, like everybody who's big now started off small and like were dragged by their business into better and more sophisticated distributed systems in terms of their architecture. So we're in that same exact phase. We're in what I have called in the past the scaling phase of, okay, now's the time to take that monolith and break it up into smaller pieces. So, and the way you ask it is really apt. You know, we have very well-defined individual business domains, around how do we acquire new members? That's a thing, you know, for a membership company. How do we make the membership or the subscription-like service really good for people? So recurring shipments that you would get with from us every, you know, a couple weeks or a month, like making that experience really good. How do people find stuff on the site? How do we get information about the items that we sell from our vendors? And how do we incorporate that around in the system, et cetera? Those are all separate domains. So the first one is member growth. We call habit formation, which is around that recurring shipments. We talk about discovery, which is how people find things on the site. et cetera, et cetera. And so right now, all of those domains more or less live in the monolith and have some ancillary services. But the where we will ultimately get to is those domains will own up and down independent services that are around their particular domain. So very apt question. And that's why I'm here. I mean, that's why I like this. The other aspect of why I like this is the architectural opportunity to take a really successful business, because why would you be in this situation if you weren't a successful business? and then we leveraged the knowledge that we now have, that frankly we didn't have, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, about, okay, here is the domain decomposition. Here is the place where we want to invest in terms of scaling the business and scaling the technology. And we do that. So it's a fun place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a really interesting thing to pull on there, which is when should you choose to go to a distributed architecture like microservices? Because I think you would agree with me on this. It's generally a huge mistake to sort of start building microservices when you're, you know, at that seeking product market fit stage. And obviously you're a bit beyond that stage now. And so you're starting to kind of break bits of your monolith apart. But how do you make that decision? What's the point at which you go, right, we need to start breaking this down?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, extremely apt question that I'm living now. there are really two motivations. So first, let me underline what you said, which I 100% agree with. 99% of the applications on the planet are and should remain monoliths. Full stop, end of story. You should only do I love distributed systems. I've lived in it for probably 25 years. And like, I just get joy from doing this kind of things. And I read the papers and I find it super exciting. And also it's a 1% situation, right? The vast majority of you should only be dragged kicking and screaming into distributed systems rather than starting from the beginning. There are a handful of counterexamples to that I can think of, and they are super rare. And I've never been in one myself where you would start with microservices. The only case that I can think of, the several cases, are the thing you are offering needs to be at massive scale out the gate, right? So you're AWS, you're offering a new service. Like, you don't start that as a monolith, because day one, it's supposedly always day one at Amazon, but like day one, when they launch the new XYZ service, like it's already got a million requests a second or whatever. And so you better be ready for that. The other thing is an example of companies like Monzo in the UK, where they're banking software. And the reason they started with microservices, because the banking domain is known up and down and left and right for 4 and 5 decades. So the domain decomposition is super obvious. And so you can, by skating to where the puck is going to be, you can get a lot of benefit. There's some great talks by Matt Smith, I want to say, from Monzo about that. And that's a decision that I'm on board with, but like, I exhausted my my examples of where you should start with microservices. Anyway, so absolutely start with a monolith, 90%, a 99% case for sure. And so only when you are at the scale that I'm talking about, where the monolith is running out of gas, do you want to move to a distributed system in the form of typically microservices. Okay, so what do I mean by running out of gas? Two things. Developer velocity is slowing down, because one of the benefits and then costs of a monolith is like, it's a single repo and everybody's, you know, on top of each other. And so if the opportunity, when developers are stepping on each other's toes, you want to pull the things apart. And that's going to solve essentially an organizational problem, an organizational like efficiency and scalability problem, by simply separate parts of the system, components or services or whatever, that are independent and isolated and able to be worked on and deployed independently. The other argument is straight up load, where like the parts of the system need to scale much faster than other parts of the system, and simply vertically scaling or like even horizontally stamping out more instances of the monolith isn't going to cut it. And so those are the two arguments that I have deployed over time about why you would want to move from monolith to microservice. But again, I will triple underline the vast majority of software on the planet should remain monolithic, and you should feel like it's too late, and then only then you should do it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I think it's worth underlining that point about sort of organizational scaling, because I think generally people think of microservices in terms of, you know, being able to scale up or scale horizontally or whatever, but they tend to miss the point that actually that's one reason for doing it. But if you've got thousands of developers working in a single repo or in a single code base, you're going to start tripping over each other and it just doesn't work. And so at that point, splitting things apart makes a bunch of sense.
Yeah. And if you were so, if you had sufficient foresight and you componentized your monolith, that makes it a lot easier. The hard case is the case where I was in at WeWork, and I'm in here, and I was mostly somewhat in at Stitch Fix the monolith isn't particularly well componentized. So step one is taking a page out of Michael Feather's Working Effectively with Legacy Codebook and like finding a seam for a component within your monolith and walling that off in your favorite interface approach, writing tests around that and extracting it. So yeah, it's a standard progression. And I've, as you know, Charles, but maybe your listeners don't, like, I've given talks on this exact thing. So you can Google my name and look for monoliths and microservices and migrations and, you know, hour-long disquisitions on thinking about this stuff.
Yeah. There's one interesting thing just to sort of connect a couple of dots in that, because you were talking about the Monzo example, and you said quite rightly with Monzo, because the problem domain is, or the domains are so well understood, basically. You can do the whole domain-driven design because you know what what your boundary contexts are, effectively. You know what your boundaries are straight away. There's an interesting sort of counter to that, which is I think sometimes you know what a lot of the boundaries are, but then you have a sort of mysterious blob over here where we're really not quite sure yet. And so you can sort of group those things together, separate them off, if you will, and then at some point you'll get clearer on what the boundaries are, and then you can start splitting those off. Does that sort of, do you see what I'm getting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's so insightful. And I actually want to riff on that for a moment, because I missed the third reason, or I'll say it this way. The reason why you do, an additional reason why you do not start with microservices is you do not understand your domain. You think you do, but you do not. Sorry. I once had hair, as the people seeing the video can tell on audio. Trust me, I'm bald. You do not understand your domain when you're starting out, and particularly when you don't fully have a business model or product market fit, you do not understand your domain. Therefore, stay as a monolith, because you can use refactoring tools to move things around and componentize and recomponentize and so on, only when your domain has quite, your overall set of domains, let's say it that way, have coalesced and you really understand your domain decomposition, then you can say, okay, well, now it's clear that I can pull out payments. Now it's clear that I can pull out member acquisition. Now it's clear that I can pull out finding or search or, you know, however you want to, the catalog. So yeah, super insightful point that, again, the only, you cannot split things into services. Once you have split something into services, you have reified your domain decomposition, like chunk, like you have coalesced is not the right word. You have taken it from solidified. That's a good word.
Right,
it's
yes.
an even better word. You have solidified it into software. And now it's really hard to refactor capabilities to undo that this particular service and like recompose it into other services. It's just harder.
Yeah.
Great point. Thank you.
That's all right. Thank you. So we, as I say, we were talking about sort of microservices kind of in the context of, it's effectively an engineering productivity thing, right? As your team gets larger. So focusing, because I think your roles at eBay in your second stint at eBay, because you were at eBay twice and at Thrive, have some similarities in the sense that you're focusing on developer productivity. So what we might call sort of platform engineering or engineering enablement in the sort of team topology sense of that. And how that sort of fits together. Is that kind of right? Is that a reasonable description of the parallels between the two?
Yeah. So like you say, I've been at eBay twice. So I was there mostly as an individual contributor from 2004 to 2011, where I worked on eBay's search engine and learned a ton about distributed systems then. And then I left and did other things for 10 years or so, worked at Google, Stitch Fix, WeWork, other places. And then in 2000, right at the start of the pandemic, I was asked back to be chief architect of eBay. So I came back and I took on the chief architect role, but also led the platform engineering organization that developed like the internal developer frameworks, the CI/CD pipelines, the external APIs, a whole bunch of stuff that's, you know, related to engineering productivity. And yeah, this is something that is very near and dear to my heart, and I care a lot about it. And so even though I wore the chief architect hat, the thing that I did first and really solely, frankly, in the 2 years that I was there was not reforming the architecture, not because it didn't need to be reformed. It did and does. But because it was very clear that what was preventing us from reforming the architecture was all aspects of software delivery, right? Like better setup for automated tests, better pipelines for canary deployment out and back. The only way I know of doing large scale change, whether it's architectural or otherwise, is in small steps that are two way doors that go forward and back. And, you know, there's the whole, how do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time. And then I love the reformulation by John Smart of Sooner, Safer, Happier, where he says you want elephant carpaccio. So like super, super, super thinly sliced pieces. And we're aggregated all together. It makes a big difference. Okay. So how did we approach that idea? So as with all things, whether it's developer productivity or architecture or whatever, you really need to understand the problem that you're solving. So if people take nothing else from this talk or, you know, this chat, remember these seven words. What problem are we trying to solve? So often as engineers, we don't ask that question. We assume we know, or we're handed off some spec or some, you know, diagram or some, you know, beautiful, sketch and implement that. Well, like if we understand why, we're going to do a better job, and we actually will get there. So understand the problem statement. At eBay, it was, you know, we had better words for it, but we were too slow. Like just end to end, it took us too long to go from idea all the way to value. And so, you know, you can, I like to think of it as like four steps. So planning is like, how does an idea become a project? Software development is, how does a project become committed code? Software delivery is, how does committed code become a feature that people use on the site? And then post-release iteration is, how does that feature that we launched initially get iterated upon based on user feedback and analytics and monitoring and so on? And we learned at eBay, we did a value stream map, which comes out of Lean. So we thought of it as a big workflow, and we looked at where the opportunities were, what was taking longer, what was taking shorter. And it became glaringly clear what a lot of people knew anecdotally and individually, but the data was really clear that it was all about software delivery at eBay. You know, there were opportunities everywhere, frankly, like planning could be a lot better, software development could be a lot better, et cetera. But like the really big opportunity there was in the software delivery space. And fortunately, we were living in the world of 2020 and still this world where we have a lot of industry expertise now, like 10, 15 years of the State of DevOps reports and the Accelerate book and the Dora metrics and so on. So what we did is we just straight up, you know, had everybody read the Accelerate book, which everybody should if you haven't already. Stop now, pause the video, go read the book, come back. And we used the Dora 4 metrics as our way of measuring our software delivery performance. And again, without going into huge detail, read the book. Dr. Nicole Forsgren, who led all that research and was the primary author of the book, proved that these four metrics of deployment frequency, of lead time for change, of change failure rate, and of mean time to recover do predict software delivery performance and therefore business and organizational performance. So we measured ourselves on, hey, how often are we deploying code? How often are we, how long does it take us from when a developer commits her code to when it shows up on the site? That's lead time for change. When we deploy things, how often do we have to roll it back or hotfix it? That's change failure rate. And then MTTR, when we have an incident, how long does it take us to recover from it? And we went to the, so we put together eBay's big and therefore they build everything themselves. So we built a tool, you know, to monitor all those things, look at our deployment pipelines, et cetera, issue tracking, et cetera, integrated that all together. And we're able to see that very quickly, which is really great. And then how do you do it from there is you just understand, you basically go to teams and you go, what's preventing you from moving faster and being more effective? And the most useful question that I could ask as the head of platform engineering was, hi, XYZ team. I see that today you're deploying maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks. If I told you that you had to deploy every day, tell me all the reasons why you can't. And this wasn't like a challenge. This was like an opportunity. And they were like, wow, somebody will finally listen. And they said, how long do you have, Randy? And like, do you want the whole list or just the top 150? And so they gave us, you know, a huge list, all legit of like, okay, well, the tests are flaky and the builds take too long and I have to get manual approvals, but not one, but not two, but like all the dependent teams that depend on the software that I build. And when I roll out, I have to have somebody hand look at it to go from, you know, the one stage to the next stage to the next stage of the deployment process. And so unlike all the other conversations and rants that, you know, those people legitimately had over the years, finally, somebody was listening to them and I said, great, you just gave my team our backlog. and then we formed a team of teams, referencing exactly the book, but a team of teams where like we would get together once a week of like all the teams that were working together on improving their software delivery performance. And we would share the things that we learned and how we're doing. And what immediately came out was everybody was motivated to make their lives better individually. And then people could share ideas and like, oh, I'm having problems getting nagging people about doing their code reviews. Other team says, hey, we implemented this super lightweight tool that nags people and like, hey, you want to use it? And, you know, so the sharing of experiences and successes was really valuable. And then overall, I inherited this word, but overall, this thing at eBay, we called the Velocity Initiative. I would have given it a different word if I'd been there, but I inherited the word. But yeah, so again, it's about improving the overall engineering productivity and flow of the organization. And one of the things I'm super proud of the work that we did together with a bunch of really great people at eBay, was that for the teams that we work with, we doubled their engineering productivity. And what does that mean, doubled? It means as measured by features and bug fixes, like produced end to end per unit time, they doubled. So given the same team composition, same team size, before we did this work, they were doing X number of, you know, features and bug fixes per week or month or whatever. And then now they're doing 2X. And like, that's cool. And I am very personally proud of it. And also, we didn't do anything magic. it's the standard. I mean, it's the playbook. It's the DevOps Accelerate Dora playbook of, in the, you know, hey, we need to do automated testing. We need to make sure that tests are not flaky. We need to automate the deployment process. So like a canary situation where a human's not pressing a button to go from stage X to stage Y to stage Z, it happens automatically. Looking at metrics, if they're good, they go forward. If they're bad, they go back. Just leveraging all the tools and techniques and capabilities that we have in the 2020s had in the 2010s in our world. And so we didn't do anything magic. We just started, we just executed and like introduced people to continuous delivery, essentially.
Yeah. How much of your engineering effort goes into that platform team at somewhere like eBay?
At eBay, that's a good question. I have noticed anecdotally, but my experience at multiple places, that as you get larger, there is a larger percentage of time spent in the what I'll call platform versus in the other areas. And that is because when you are small, the amount of leverage you get by a common platform team is small. It only is over the whatever 20 or 30 people you have, let's say. But when you are 4,000 engineers like eBay, or you are 100,000 engineers like Google, or maybe it's 200,000 at Amazon's some crazy number at this point, like the tiniest little, you know, three person team in platform that does what seems like a relatively small thing has this massive impact and pays for themselves like in a week. So at eBay scale, it's basically half and half. So what eBay, I don't know if they've reorganized, but when I was recently there, we had what we called the product engineering organization, which delivered user-facing features, and they were excellent. And then we had the core tech. So like think writ large, the platform organizations. That's infrastructure, that's DevOps, that's my platform engineering, blah, 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 all sorts of different things. And it was basically half and half. So order 2,000 engineers on the product engineering side and 2,000 engineers on the core tech side. And when I was there, Google had a similar ratio, the user-facing things versus the multiple really excellent layers of software that everything is built on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally, totally. There are a couple of other things about platform teams that I've seen people come unstuck with. One of those is how you prioritize the work that comes in and how you manage that relationship, because it's a bit of an unusual relationship. It's a bit like a vendor customer relationship rather than it's different from, you know, other internal teams. I think I'm not, yeah, you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I do. And you used a metaphor that I like to use straight away, which is vendor customer. So how, as a platform team, do I understand what to do? I talk to my customers, and just as if I was a third party vendor, I prioritize based on that. Like, okay, I think of my thing as a product, my platform as a product, and I use product management techniques and lean product management to like figure out what to do. So it's exactly like any third party vendor. Listen to your customers, you know, and prioritize the largest opportunities / the largest pain points first. And so does that mean that every customer gets exactly what they want when they want? No, that's what prioritization is. Like, we don't have infinite resources to do everything, but it's correct for a third party vendor. And it is equivalently correct for an internal platform team to say, if I work on this thing, it impacts most or all of the teams and makes them substantially more productive. And if I do this other thing that this particular customer team is asking for, that really only makes them more productive. And so, okay, that prioritization is really clear. So put your eBay hat on, right? Put your broad company hat on. Like, what is the correct thing for us to improve, you know, what to, as a member, like what would the executive say, essentially? Like what's the overall priority of the organization? And once you put that hat on, that like pretend you're a vendor, it all becomes really clear. And again, you can't do everything, but you prioritize and you say, hey, I can't get to this time, but you know, 2 quarters from now, sure, I'll be happy to do it. And also, you know, one of the benefits of running that organization is like, guess what? We'll happily consult with you. Like, if you want to roll your own thing to do your kind of custom improvement, we can help you and point you in the right direction, but we just can't do it for you right now.
Yeah. There's another thing that I mean, it's become something of a maxim that people talk about, the fact that you shouldn't mandate the use of a platform. But I think it's worth talking about it, because I still see people sort of go, no, we've built a platform and now you've got to use that. And yeah. I think there's interesting aspects of that. So can you just sort of riff on that a bit? What's your sort of view on mandating versus, you know, just allowing it, having it there? Why would you favor one over the other?
Yeah, fantastic question. I love it. This is the distinction is it a mandated platform? Is it a paved path? And I'm very intentionally stealing that phrase from Netflix. So Netflix and Google are excellent at this. Let me give a slightly more new. So in general, I prefer the paved path, or almost exclusively, I prefer the paved path versus the mandate. And I'll explain why in a moment. I want to give a little more nuanced thing, which if you're small, it shouldn't be mandated, but like, there's not a lot of excuse at my scale for people to roll their own, because like, we only have 100 engineers. At Google scale with 100,000 engineers, there's a lot more play, and frankly, a lot more, the distribution of individual teams' needs is much broader. But overall, my philosophy is if you have to, it should be, the platform should be so good that people should want to choose it affirmatively. So it needs to be affirmatively better, strictly better than buying it, borrowing it, or stealing it. And that's the choice, because it is right for me as the internal software vendor of platform teams to give my customers the choice. Why? because it puts all the incentives in the correct places. The customer team is correctly, if they're good engineers, which they mostly are, like they're choosing what works best for them. And sometimes that's mostly the time that's the platform. Other, okay, but if they have weird, you know, not weird, but like different needs, like, okay, well, for machine learning, hey, this like, this thing isn't going to do it. Like you need something else. So it puts the customer in control where they should be, essentially the customer team in this example, but also it gives me as the platform team the right incentives as well. Like if I'm essentially competing with all the other options my customer teams can have, like now I'm like a third party vendor back again. Like, okay, how am I going to survive as a going concern? Like if it is strictly better for my customers to use a managed service from our cloud vendor instead of the thing I built, great. I should want that, because guess what? There's other stuff I should do. if we can get this thing as a managed service, or there's a third party that does this, like, fantastic. Thanks. Glad what I did helped you, and you know, from the past. And then now we're going to do other things, because again, there's that big long list of priorities from my customers that we weren't able to get to. And I 100% believe that the reason why people would mandate a platform, I think, are deeply wrong. They are the, I don't mean to be mean, but it's the bias of sunk cost. It's a sunk cost fallacy. It's like, well, I built this, so you should use it. I'm like, well, okay, we spent that money. Now what?
Yes.
And if the right thing today is to continue to use the platform, great, we did a good job and we should pat ourselves on the back. But if, as often happens, that was the right thing to do 4 years ago, but right now there's a third party that has packaged that up for free and it's all integrated and way better in the cloud ecosystem, in the Kubernetes and, you know, CNCF ecosystem. Like at any given year, there's way more stuff out in the world in open source, et cetera, than there was the year before. Right. So I hope this metaphor is going to work, but like the overall like tide in a good way is rising, right? The baseline level of what's out there for free or for cheap in the industry is going up. And that's a good thing. We should want to float on top of that rather than chaining ourselves to the bottom of the harbor, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. There's actually an interesting sort of line I want to pull on there, which is, because obviously eBay has been around by kind of internet company standards a long time. And when you started, or when it started out, you know, the cloud wasn't even a thing. So if you were building an eBay today, or something like an eBay today, what would be different? Are there more off-the-shelf services that you would maybe draw on that you couldn't have drawn on at the time? And how would that look? How would that compare?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love this. I actually did this thought experiment when I was at eBay as the chief architect. What should the chief architect do? The chief architect should be thinking about, hey, if I had to do eBay all over again, what would I do? And I would make, what's the way to say this? Most of the pattern, I'll give specific examples, but like most of the patterns are correct and I would keep. Most of the implementations I would update, right? So the patterns are, well, let's take it one at a time. So eBay does not use public cloud, basically. eBay leverages its own private cloud. Because guess what? When eBay started almost now 30 years ago, we're at 29 years right now, there was no cloud, like you say. The first thing you do is you buy some actual physical hardware from an actual physical vendor. You install software on it, like from a CD or a floppy. You rack it in a rack. You put it in a data center, blah, blah, blah. And companies that got big early on in internet time, eBay, Amazon, Yahoo, Google, all had to learn how to do that. So they all learned how to be their own, what we would now call cloud vendors. And eBay is pretty good at that, actually. And from a cost perspective, if you think, that's the way to say this, if you lifted and shifted all of eBay's infrastructure from the private setup that they currently have to the public cloud, it would probably increase the cost, let's call it 4x. But if you were smart, you could get a lot of benefit and it wouldn't be 4x, if that makes any sense. Like if you just lifted and shifted, it would be that way. So what I would do today is I would leverage, go all in on one of the cloud vendors. I partner with them up and down and left and right, exactly how, you know, Netflix has done and various other big places have done. I would build from the ground up in an auto-scaled way. So again, when you run your own data centers, like physical things don't flex in the way that we would like. And now we've learned what we can do with autoscaling. So I would do that. The reason why I said all in on a cloud vendor is I would by default use all of their managed services up and down and left and right. And only where the managed service didn't meet a very specific need that we had, which is frankly a rare case in these days in 2024, only then would I build a custom infrastructure. And then the other thing, which eBay, again, you know, it's legit. eBay built and builds and maintains its own data centers. There are three data centers in the United States, and mostly the Western United States. So that's great if you happen to live in the United States. That's not great if you happen to live in Australia. So if I had it to do all over again, I would go, if I had to jet to where we currently are, we're not eBay as a startup, we're eBay at current scale, let's say it that way. I would be global, multi-region, active, right? So I haven't directly used a Spanner from Google or the brand spanking new thing from Amazon, Aurora DSQL that they just announced like a few weeks ago at reInvent, which is Spanner plus, as far as I can tell, Spanner even better. Anyway, I would leverage something that was, you know, all the capabilities that are like multi-region from the beginning, if that makes sense. So that's what I would do on infrastructure. Again, it is correct that something at eBay scale would be microservices. I would continue to do that. eBay, you know, evolved over time. Like if you could jet right to the domain decomposition that we've currently learned or that eBay's currently learned, we would just, you know, construct services around that. That's fine. We would do what eBay does today. Wasn't when I was there the first time, but, you know, really in a DDD way, organizing teams and services aligned to those domains, like very clearly, you know, segmented there, you know, in bounded context, like you were suggesting earlier. I would be event driven from the beginning. Again, we're not being a startup, we're being eBay at current scale. And I would go either all in on a cloud, whatever cloud I chose, I would go all in on their eventy setup. Or if I didn't like that for whatever reason, I would go all in on Kafka. And then I, because we can't get past functions as a service even 10 years along, I would use those as kind of lightweight event producers and consumers. But despite the like serverless first, I don't think starting it with functions as a service is the right way to go. It's a tool in our toolbox, but it's not the first tool. Now, serverless, as AWS says writ large, like everything should be scalable down to zero and scalable up to a million. Like, yes, 100,000 times yes. And then the very last thing is I would do a first order implementation of workflows. So whether that's a Saga pattern layered over an eventing system or something that's new to me, but I think it's not new to most people or a lot of people, is something like Temporal, which is, you know, used by Coinbase and Stripe and a bunch of places that this stuff really matters. We're currently looking into that now about like how to implement workflows in a very higher level, like correct and very reliable way. So that's what I would do.
That's absolutely fascinating.
I was going to say, did I indicate that I've been thinking about this for a while?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting though, because it's something I've been reflecting on a bit, and actually something you said earlier about when you came back to eBay and you basically used the work from the Accelerate book and continuous delivery and all of that. And so much of that is stuff that wasn't there 20 years ago. It's like the patterns and approaches that we need are so much better defined for the scale that we operate at than they were a few years ago. And it's kind of interesting, I think to reflect back on that. Actually on that, because we're getting towards the end of our time. Obviously you and I met, I think at KubeCon San Francisco in 2007, quite a long time ago now. So we've talked about how you would do eBay differently, but how have the sort of architectural principles or approaches changed over the sort of 20 or so years that you and I have known each other?
Yeah. In preparation for this talk, I actually was listening to an interview I did at KubeCon London in 2008 for Software Engineering Radio, but whatever. That's another good podcast. I listen to GoTo all the time too as well. Don't worry. And I was listening to the themes from that talk, which was the same talk that you saw at KubeCon San Francisco in 2007. And oh my gosh, all the patterns are the same. Like, and it's not because Randy was brilliant. It's because it took us a while to learn. It took us maybe 5 or 10 years to learn how to do distributed systems, but then we learned them and patterns. The patterns are the same. The detail infrastructure, detail implementations are very different. So number one was scaling. Okay. Domain partitioning of our service, domain decomposition, services per domain, microservices that own their own data. Boom. We knew that then. We know that now, 17 years later. Asynchrony, again, particularly at large scale, prefer an event-driven architecture over everything being synchronously coupled, and go all in on the implication that there is eventual consistency from something happens over here when somebody bids on an event, and only later does it show up in search, and only later does it show up in these other places. Now, at eBay, we did a lot of work, so the later was it shows up in a couple of seconds in search. But, you know, the conceptual idea of a thing happens over here in one part of the system, and then it propagates quickly or slowly, you know, to the rest of the system in like an eventually consistent way. The automation. So you cannot live at large scale without automating everything up and down and left and right. And that is things like a canary rollout, right? So automating the steps to roll things out, what I call adaptive configuration. So say to a part of the system, here is your SLO. I need you as an event consumer to consume or message consumer to consume messages at a certain rate and keep the queue of messages below a certain level. And then tune your polling rate and your parallel threads and your number of consumers to keep that rate with minimal, you know, with minimal research usage. And that's not conceptually all that difficult, but you just have to implement it. We could talk about machine learning. That's automation at massive scale, but same exact thing. I think it's the first, and then failure. I think it's the first fallacy of distributed systems. It's certainly in there. Like, the you know, things fail all the time. So, you know, you have to invest in some form or another. Now you can use third parties, but like invest in observability, step one. And then, as I was mentioning, you know, things fail in every way. So like canaries and automated rollback, you know, looking at those monitoring metrics to decide, you know, what to do to scale up and down. What we now call, thanks to Mike Nygaard, circuit breakers. We had that technique at eBay back 20 years ago. We called it markdown, like you mark down a database that temporarily when it's not performing well. So circuit breakers like that. And then when things aren't available, you don't collapse, you gracefully degrade the functionality. So, and then a thing that's a little bit new, well, okay, the massive thing that's new is what you hinted, which is continuous delivery. So those other like patterns around scaling, around asynchrony, around automation, and around failure, those were things were known, different words, but like we knew them all 20 years ago, and we're you know, at least the at the time secret big companies knew all these things. And it wasn't just eBay, by the way. Yahoo, Google, everybody knew it. The thing that is massively different today versus 20 years ago is all aspects of continuous delivery. So when I first gave that talk back in 2006 about, hey, here's how we're doing things at eBay, opening up the hood a little bit, people were amazed, shocked that we released the entire site every 2 weeks. So like, oh my God, how do you do it? And we're like so proud. We're like, well, we compute the transitive closure of all the interdependencies of all the different services and applications, and we execute on that in this automated way. We're like, up the DAG from the leaves to the root, rolling forward and back to based on things. And we were so proud, but we thought of the site as this monolithic thing. And we released the whole site, you know, in pieces, but like the whole site every 2 weeks. Now that would be laughable. Absolutely laughable. I don't remember the exact thing, but like Amazon way 10 years ago was doing hundreds of thousands of deployments every day. I don't know that they've said it now, but let's say that it's two orders of magnitude larger. Google would be the same. So the idea, you know, and it's first, you know, credit to Assemble and Dave Farley for the continuous delivery book in 2010, the very famous 10 deploys a day talk, which I was lucky enough to attend at Velocity from John Allspaugh and Paul Hammond back in 2009. So now it's crazy talk to think that you shouldn't be deploying multiple times a day for each individual thing. So that's the, on all the techniques that you say that are around continuous delivery. And I think we knew all the individual techniques, but we never layered them together and combined them in a way that would allow us to safely deploy micro changes in a constant stream. And now we do. And now the best in class companies, those high performers, you know, in the Accelerate / Dora milieu, are doing intraday every application multiple deployments. And that's the standard. And you would be laughed at if you were a big site and updated everything every 2 weeks. So we've come a long way. The patterns are all the same. I love. And that's like, it's really exciting to me to see that we as an industry discovered all these things, co-discovered, right? Like they're all being like, nobody's talked to anybody, super secret, but like Yahoo and eBay and Amazon and Google all co-discovering all these techniques all at once, you know, feature flags and canaries and circuit breakers. And anyway, super and the broader techniques as well. Anyway, love that. And love that those patterns are still just as relevant today as they were. And also love that we've come a long way on the continuous delivery front. So 2024 is a great time to be a software engineer.
100%. Randy, thank you so much. As ever, I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but that was wonderful as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charles. Me too. Clearly, we can talk on any of these topics forever, but really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.